Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Fred Wilcox. He's the author of 8 books and editor of 2, including Waiting for an Army to Die, The Tragedy of Agent Orange, and Scorched Earth, Legacies of Chemical Warfare in Vietnam. Wilcox is an environmental and anti-war activist as well as an advocate for veterans. His most recent book is Shamrocks and Oil Slicks. So first, thank you for your work in the world, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Well, thank you for inviting me. And I really appreciate it.
So, let's talk about Shamrocks and Oil Slicks. What is the book about?
The book is about Shell Oil going to Ireland, a very rural area of Ireland, way back in about 2002, and announcing that it was going to build a refinery, a gas refinery. People initially thought that was a good idea because they're very poor and they thought that there would be jobs. In fact, the church was advertising, the local church, that everybody was going to get rich. So it's about what happened after that when people began to discover they didn't know anything about Shell Oil. They had no idea of the crimes that Shell had committed in Nigeria and other parts of the world. But when they found out, they developed a resistance movement, that is fishermen, farmers, housewives, all kinds of people. And they fought Shell Oil for 15 years. Shell did build a refinery, but the book is about courage. The book is about people taking a stand and just refusing, no matter what, to back off and to stop their resistance.
Well, that's I really love this book, and one of the reasons I loved it is because it is such a great model, and we so desperately need resistance, and the lessons in the book are applicable all over the world.
Oh, definitely.
So there's two directions we can go. We can either can you tell me some stories or tell us some stories of particular resistance from that struggle. Let's do that first. The other direction to go later would be what are some of the lessons that are applicable around the world?
Okay, sure. Well, when I went over the first time, I met a guy, they called him Pat the Chief O'Donnell. And Pat the Chief is a fisherman. He comes from generations of fishermen. And he fishes in a bay there. It's called Broadhaven Bay. So Pat got involved with the resistance and told me that he had been in prison more than once. He had been beaten up by the police more than once, beaten pretty badly. His boat was sunk by, he didn't know who, some people with wearing balaclavas and wearing guns. He was out in the bay and this boat came up and these guys boarded his boat. And basically they sunk it and he would have probably died, but he had a little boat, a little dinghy up in the wheelhouse of his fishing boat. And he got into that with another fellow on the boat and escaped. Now, Pat is just a very interesting, very courageous man. He was not a political activist. Never in his life did he do anything like that. But he refused. He was offered a huge amount of money if he would just stop fishing. Shell Oil said, we'll just stop fishing. And what they really meant was just stop badgering us, stop fighting us. And he refused the money because Pat told me, look, if you take the money, then you have to shut up. You can't talk. If you take the bribe, then you're finished as an objector. And so Pat was one of the people that I most admire. And he's just a guy that just refused to quit no matter what. And even after they sank his boat right out from under him, there's another fellow by the name of Terence Conway, who was a great help in writing the book, drove me all over Ireland. And Terence was got a video camera. He had never had one before. And he would go to the demonstrations and videotape the violence because the police were quite violent. They would, and this is one of the things that really interested me because I told these people, well, yeah, I've been beaten up by the police, but I didn't know who they were. You know, they didn't wear badges. But there in Ireland, everybody in that part of Ireland, everybody knows everybody. They go to church together. They grow up together. And so I was rather astonished that the Gardaí, as they call them, would beat up people that they knew, that they'd known sometimes all of their life. Well, Terrence would go to these demonstrations and videotape the violence, because some people would, of course, the police would deny that they'd committed these acts of violence. So he wanted to make sure that there was a solid record. And that took some courage, because he was risking getting beat up himself. There are just so many people there. I could have written several books, Darren, you know, because there were so many people involved in this resistance. One little story is that when I first moved there, or I went, not moved there, but went there, we went up the road to the, where the refinery was still being built, and it started to rain, and it was so cold. It was really bitter cold. And I stood out in the rain, and all I wanted to do was go home and have a cup of tea. And there were a whole lot of people there, and they told me that they'd gone there to that site every morning before work, whatever they were doing, for six straight years. And I thought, wow, for six straight years, standing in this rain, standing in the wind, the cold, risking getting arrested or beaten, 6 years. So I think this book, I didn't want to write an academic book. I didn't want to write a negative book. I didn't want to write a sad book. What I wanted to do was tell these people's stories so that people can see that actually people working together, people steadfast, can accomplish. I mean, there's so much doomsaying now where you can't do anything. You can't accomplish anything. The forces of wickedness or whatever, capitalism, are just too strong. And in this case, even though Shell built a refinery, I think if you read this book, you'll see people working together can achieve all kinds of amazing things.
So can we back up a second? And
certainly.
How did it move? How did this, as you answer this question, I'm wondering, what I'm hoping for is that listeners can see a model that they can build their own local resistance movement. How did this move from, hey, this refinery is going to make us all rich and the church mm-hmm. promoting it? How did it move to having people stand there, every day for 6 years? Can you tell us about the origins? Was it one person
sure.
speaking up, or was it three people speaking up? Was it, how did it start, and then how did it grow?
Well, it started by a man, his name is Mahol. He went to the barracks, the police barracks, where they kept the environmental impact statement, Shell's environmental impact statement, and he sat there and read it. And what he found out, he was astonished to discover that Shell planned to dump toxic chemicals into the drinking water of this community. There's a lake there. And it's water for 10,000 people. And Shell had said right in their environmental impact statement that they were going to dump all these wicked chemicals into the water. They also stated in that same impact statement that they were going to dump all kinds of toxic chemicals into Broadhaven Bay, where the fishermen fished and made their living. So once people discovered that, they held a meeting and they talked
about
–
Wait, hold on a second.
Sure.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but the reason I want to say this is because when people think about resistance, they often think about quite dramatic things. But I just really want to underscore, and if you can really underscore this too, that a lot of resistance is boring. It's like, actually, it wouldn't have happened if this guy wouldn't have gone down and read this horrible, probably 500-page document that's full of legalese and full of all sorts of crap. And full of all sorts of lies that he has to wend his way through. And resistance often starts with stuff that's really boring. So I just wanted to highlight that for a second.
Well, boring, I mean, yes, he read the environmental, and it was surely boring. Mahol is a very interesting guy, he speaks Irish and he's a singer and all kinds of things. So he's certainly not boring, but he was shocked. He was appalled. He called the little uglies, the things in this environmental impact statement. So he got together with a group of people and they just started talking. And of course they were all shocked because initially they had heard from the church and from other sources that this was a good thing, you know, that their community was going to have all kinds of good things as a result of Shell building. So they did. They had meetings, and you're absolutely right. Resistance oftentimes is just talking. planning, you know, trying something, it doesn't work, it doesn't, you know, it fails, and then you try something else. And it's also, if you look at the this organization called Shell to See, they didn't agree. You know, they were human beings. They argued, they fought, they disagreed on what should be done and should not be done. But they realized the bigger picture, that if they did not resist, Shell was going to build a pipeline, for example, from about a 9-mile pipeline that was incredibly high pressure gas inside. If it exploded, this is right by their houses, really close to their houses. If it exploded, they would just all die instantly. They would burn to death. So they were certainly appalled by that. And, you know, they tried to, this is what's interesting to me about these movements, because I was involved in the anti-war movement during the Vietnam War, and we did the same thing. They tried to communicate with Shell. They wanted to talk to Shell. They wanted to ask them questions. And then they also wanted to tell them what they knew about their own environment, about the soil and the water and things. And Shell just absolutely refused to listen. They had contempt for these people. They thought if they beat them up enough and arrested them enough and put enough people in prison that they would quit. And they did not quit. And this is a story that's, you know, taking place all over the world, you know, in the Amazon, all sorts of places people are doing this. And I think that the strength of it is we need to all know that we can prevail over these forces, because Shell is mighty. It's a, you know, one of the largest multinational corporations in the world.
So we have this one person goes in and reads the documents and then tells other people what's going on, and mm-hmm. you get a few people then trying to figure out what to do, and then how did it develop from there?
Well, it developed from there that, as I said, they tried to communicate with Shell, and they began to realize that what Shell wanted to do was just propaganda. Shell has a great propaganda machine. In the book, I quote their nonsense about how they work with communities, how they care about communities, how they really want to communicate with communities. And so they found out right away that Shell had nothing but contempt for them. Shell thought they were just sort of rural people, rural Irish people, and really wouldn't know much of anything about anything. And so they kept holding these meetings. And then, it was very interesting to me, Derek, because I asked them, did you study Martin Luther King or did you study Gandhi? Or, you know, because they were nonviolent. If all throughout their resistance, they were nonviolent. And they told me, no, this is just the way we live. This is our attitude. This is the way we interact with people, which I found really fascinating because of the violence that was perpetuated against them. So eventually they formed a group called Shell to See, and then they decided on what they would do. That, you know, they talked a lot and argued a lot. Well, what's the best strategy? Where should we go? How should we demonstrate? In 2005, Shell made a very, very big mistake. They went onto some farmers' lands, and the farmers said, we don't want you on our land. And Shell got an order so that they could be on the land. And then they arrested five local men. And that was when things really turned around in Ireland. Because then, before then, a lot of this was not, people didn't know about it. It wasn't a national thing. But after they arrested these men, for trying to protect their own land, which if you read Irish history, was really stupid move. You really should not do that. That's what the colonizers, that's what the British have done for hundreds of years. They put these people in jail. They stayed there for 94 days. They could have gotten out. All they had to do was apologize for their behavior and say they would never do that again. They would never resist Shell Oil. They would allow them onto their land. But they wouldn't. They said they wouldn't. So when these men got out of prison, there was a great event. All kinds of people, thousands of people in the streets of Dublin. They had bonfires all the way home. They were greeted with great enthusiasm. So they became national heroes. And as a result, more and more people began to see what Shell Oil had planned, what they were going to do, and just how devious and how dangerous this company is.
So you mentioned that thank you for that story. You've mentioned that there were conflicts as to how, as to tactics or to strategies or various conflicts within the resistance. And do you know how those conflicts were generally resolved? Were they,
through
sorry, go ahead.
Sometimes yelling as a row, as they call it in Ireland. They had the rows. They argued, they yelled, they shouted. And, but you know, there's a film called The Pipe, and it's about Shell Oil. I mean, it's about the movement, Shell to Sea. And you see there, there's a meeting and everybody's shouting and yelling, and one person starts throwing things on the floor. And then they all stop and go home and offer one another rides because they realize that they had to continue working together. They could argue. Most of the arguments, I think, were about how much resistance, that direct confrontation, should you be nonviolent. I think they all agreed to be nonviolent, but how would you direct that nonviolence toward the police or toward Shell? Some people just wanted to be a little more confrontational than others, which in my own experience has always been the case. You know, people argue about how confrontational you should be. So that was the main issue, I think.
Well, the reason I'm asking this is because, okay, this is going to be a little bit of a long, long question here. Mm-hmm. That so often these days, especially in the United States, the left just completely fractures, and, you know, fractures over what we eat or various, you know, all sorts of things. It's like you worked with the church. So now I'm going to be mad at you because I don't like the church. And so right. I will never speak to you again. And you know, there's this tremendous fracturing going on. And then I'm thinking of a couple things. One of them is that I used to teach at a prison, and I asked one of my students there who was from Mexico and had been a mule bringing stuff up to the United States. I was like, how did you know whom to trust? And he said, it was my cousin. It was somebody who grew up with me in the village. So, you know, when they were, and they're not doing a good thing. They're muling drugs across the border. That's not good. But it's like, how did they stay cohesive even when they were arrested? Well, it's because I knew him since I was a child. And then I'm thinking one other thing about a friend of mine, Jeanette Armstrong. She's an Okanagan Indian writer and activist. And she once said to me, you know, we Indians have the same problem that you white people do. We get mad at each other, everything else. But the difference is I know my great-grandchild might marry your great-grandchild because we're planning on living here for the next 500 years.
Right.
And mm-hmm. so we have to figure out ways to get along. So I'm wondering if what advice can you give to American activists? Do you know what I'm talking about with all this splintering?
I wished I really could get advice. My only advice is if we don't get together, if we don't agree to set aside some of our differences, if we want to be fragmented and fighting over who's right about everything, we're going to lose. We can't prevail that way for anything. I look back, you know, during the Vietnam War, and we had basically three things, the civil rights movement and then the anti-war movement and the women's movement. But I think we weren't as fractured as we are now. People weren't fighting whether you were pro this or anti this, whether you ate meat or not or whatever it might be. I just think if we're going to work together, if we hope to succeed and build a better world and defeat the people that are determined to destroy our planet, then we have to lay some of our differences aside and decide what's best for Mother Earth and not best for our group or our organization or our policy. And I understand people want, you know, there are a lot of great issues, a lot of things that need to be resolved. But it frustrates me. I get sad sometimes when I see that people, if somebody deviates in some way from what other people believe, then they repudiate that person or his or her ideas or her actions. And I think we really must focus on, to me, the focus has to be, well, are we going to save this planet or not? Are we going to do it? And if we're going to do it, we have to work together, all of us, no matter what our beliefs, religious beliefs, political beliefs, sexual beliefs, we have to do it together.
So in this particular case, how, if they're yelling at each other, having a row, as you say, and then driving each other home, was this, how did they do this and we don't? Was it partly because they were living in a community that was pretty close knit and traditional, and this is your neighbor, and yeah, you might get mad at your neighbor, but they're still your neighbor, or was there more to it?
Well, yeah, I mean, some people have lived there for five generations. They lived all the way back to the Great Hunger, you know, they knew the land, they knew their neighbors, they knew the traditions, they knew what could be done and what couldn't be done. Nevertheless, some people I did talk to were bitter because some of the neighbors did not stand behind them, did not help them, did not join the effort. And that's because of Shell's enormous amount of money and cleverness. And, you know, Shell went around and offered people money. They said, sign this paper and you'll get money, pennies really for their land. But some people, when you need money, it's like with fracking, you know, some of the farmers around where I live, well, they need money. They're about to go under. They can't pay their taxes. So, you know, fracking companies come along and say, we'll help you out of debt. We'll make you sure you can keep your farm. So there were divisions based upon, I think, not so much neighbors disliking one another, distrusting one another, or hating one another, as people feeling that here's an opportunity, here's something that I can take to get out of debt, or to you know, build my new house or get some more animals for my farm. It was more about Shell's deviousness and cleverness. You know, you read their promotion material. You know, they have experts, they have psychologists, they have lawyers, they have PhDs, they have all kinds of people. Then, you know, how can you manipulate people? What's the best way to turn people against one another? What's the best way to get people to accept our own lies and our own bribes? Because that's what Shell offered. They offered bribes. And what they offered also is just endless lies about what they were going to do and how it would benefit people. So I can't say there was any one reason why people did not agree to oppose Shell, except that people in that area have come from a very long line of very poor people. And it just seemed like a way out of that poverty for some people.
So did the police beatings, how did that end up working out, given that the, as you said, the police would be their neighbors and go to church with them? How did that end up causing huge rifts in the community, and how did that story play out?
Well, you know, one of the things that really interests me about my research, going over to Ireland a couple of times and hanging out with the people there, is that no one supported the resistors. The church didn't abandon them. The media insulted them and maligned them. The state didn't support them. So when the police beat them for no reason and threw them in ditches for no reason, because they were not being violent, they weren't doing anything except trying to protect their own land and their own country, there was no recourse. They were taken into court. The judges sided with Shell. The judges were not there to protect the people. They're not there to enforce good legislative land. You know, so they just were up against terrible things. And that's one of the things that the police was so terrible for these people, is there was no recourse. The police could beat them with impunity. They felt that the orders came down from on high, that somebody said to these police, go ahead, do whatever you feel like, beat them, throw them in ditches. And then, you know, they'll go to court. And what will happen is they'll get charged, which is what happens here a lot, with resisting arrest or assaulting a police officer. The fellow I told you about, Pat, the chief, you know, he was charged with assaulting a police officer. Well, he said he didn't do it, but when he went to court, the judge called him a thug and insulted him and sent him off to prison. So it was a situation where, you know, I the last chapter of my book is called Orders, and it's about following orders. And I'm really fascinated by, why do people follow orders? You know, why do they attack their own friends? Why do they follow orders to kill people? And I don't know the answer to that. All I know is that one of the most troubling aspects of this whole situation in Ireland was that these police followed orders. They followed orders to beat up people they knew, knowing that these people were not doing anything criminally. They were not really breaking any law. They were simply standing in a road or standing beside the sea and trying to say, we want our country. It's ours. It doesn't belong to Shell. We don't want the water poisoned. We don't want to drink poisoned water. We want the fishermen to be able to fish as long as they want to. And that's it. They were saying that's all they were doing. And, you know, I don't think that's not that astonishing, because, as you know, it happens here all the time. You know, people protesting pipelines or whatever they might be protesting. And I know from the Vietnam War that the police certainly were, you know, more than happy to beat us up, break my leg, whatever they wanted to do. But we didn't know them. I mean, the thing that really troubled me about the island is I didn't know the policeman that broke my leg in Washington, D.C. You know, I never saw him before nor after. But I think what troubles these people is they believed in the police. They believed in the guard. It's a national police. They don't have local police departments. They have a national police department. And that the police people I talked with there, were they liked the police. They trusted them. They believed in them. They said, they're our police, our national police force. So, of course, they were shocked and troubled and depressed and horrified when the police turned on them, when they weren't doing anything really to violate the law.
So we've got the movement growing. You know, you said how it started, and then mm-hmm. and how it grew, and then how did it get to the stage where it was somewhat popular, and then it got to the stage where there would be bonfires all the way back home to welcome? How did they raise it to that level?
Well, that happened because Shell, you know, they had ordered these men to allow Shell onto their own land. The court had. And so Shell thought, well, we have it made. You know, we can go on to these farmers. These farmers don't want us on their land. They've been there for several generations. You know, it's their land, but we can do whatever we want. And they also thought, Shell thought, that arresting these five men, four of them farmers, one of them was a school teacher, and sending them to prison, that these men would give in. They would give up. They were not political activists. They had never done anything like this in their life. And they thought, well, we'll put them in prison and that'll end the movement. Shell to Sea will give up. People will just stop when they see what's going to happen here. But it didn't. It had the opposite effect. And it had the opposite effect because had Shell just read a little bit of Irish history, they would have known that this is the worst thing you can do in Ireland. You know, to try to take somebody's land away from them, try to tell them what to do with their own land. My God, Ireland fought for hundreds of years so that they could do that, so they could feel secure in their own land, that somebody could not just come along and take it away from them. So arresting these men and sending them to prison was a great mistake Shell made, and it was a great thing for these men, because they were willing to stay as long as Shell wanted to keep them there. They stayed for 94 days. These were all family men. They were all, you know, they'd never committed a crime or done anything wrong in their lives. But they had made up their minds, okay, this is it. We're not apologizing for trying to defend our own land. We're not apologizing to Shell for them after they've sent us to prison. There's no reason to do that. And we'll just stay. So as the longer they stayed, you know, people were actually sending them letters and postcards and things from all over the world. It got out to Ireland, Europe, all over the world. People were coming to see them. And that was really the turning point in the resistance movement, that 2005, when these five men were put in prison.
And take the story from there, please.
Well, then they got out, and of course they were released, and they were supposed to behave in the sense that they were supposed to not resist anymore. They were supposed to have learned their lesson. Shell is mighty powerful. They'll put you in jail. They'll take your land, whatever they feel like doing. But that didn't happen. What happened is more people at that point realized what Shell was up to. They realized that Shell was going to build this pipeline. It was extremely dangerous thing. They realized that Shell was going to poison the water. And they found all this out, and said more and more people joined the movement. The movement just got really bigger. The demonstrations got bigger. There were more and more demonstrations as a result of the publicity that these five men received, because, like I said, they were just not going to give up. They're not going to give up. And that's, of course, something that in Ireland, again, if you read their history, when people do that, refuse to give up, even willing to die, at that point, people admire them. People stand behind them. Not everybody, you know, but that's part of Irish history. So the movement got a lot bigger and a lot stronger. And when I first went to Ireland, it really seemed that people were convinced that maybe they could stop the building of this refinery. Maybe it just wouldn't happen. But again, Shell just violated the law. They got people, they paid people off. They used the police, they used the courts. And so they built a refinery. But I think my argument is this was a tremendous victory for these people, even though Shell built a refinery. You know, Shell only stayed about 6 months after they built a refinery. They sold it and left Ireland. And Ireland has now declared that they're going to be fossil free. They're soon, not that long, not 2050, but rather soon. And I think had it not been for these people, these resistors, that would not have happened. So, you know, I always say, you know, my friend Philip Berrigan always said, if you try to measure the difference you make, then you won't make any difference. But I think it's very easy to measure the difference that these people have made in Ireland and to other people who are trying to resist pipelines and resist refineries and resist their forests being cut down or resist their waters being polluted. It's a great inspiration to know that some people, a lot of people in this world, just are not going to back down. They're not going to stop.
So how did you come to write this particular book?
Well, I saw the thing on the internet. I've been to Ireland many times. I've lived there. I love Ireland. I love Irish literature. So when I saw what was going on the internet, I just decided, well, you know, I'll fly over there and see what's happening, which I did. And once I got there, of course, people were very kind to me, very generous with their time and told me their stories. And I just, at first, like I said, I was shocked. I think I had a little bit of a romantic idea of how Ireland works. I didn't know that the police would beat people up like that, even their friends, even their neighbors. I didn't know that, as the people didn't know that. I really didn't think it's a small country. Everybody pretty much knows everybody else. It's really one big small town. So I didn't think a multinational corporation could come into Ireland and just decide what they were going to do and then go ahead and use all kinds of force, bribes, whatever, to do it. I was a little naive about how Ireland is run, who runs Ireland, you know, who controls Ireland. So I went over, and when I found out what these people were doing, I decided I would try to write a book about it. And it took me a very, very long time to find somebody who was willing to put it in print. But I did. And, I don't know, you're a writer. I always think, well, okay, so somebody will see what I've written before, you know, and they'll say, sure, you know, we'll publish your book. That isn't necessarily true. And I'm happy that I did find Monthly Review Press. They did publish the book, or they are publishing the book, and that people will have an opportunity to learn that story, what happened in County Mayo, Ireland.
So before we, I want to talk about the lessons from this resistance for other places, but I want to come back to one thing. I guess I'm really struck by, neighbors beating up neighbors because, and not the Roe thing earlier, but the cops. And mm-hmm. You know, honestly, if one of my neighbors was a cop and they beat me over a political protest, I don't know that I could forgive that neighbor. And has that violence done by the police had a lasting harm on the community?
Oh, yes, definitely. I don't think that people there, at least the ones I've talked to, at this point anyway, are able to forgive the people who attacked them. Yeah, I don't think so. Like I said, they were shocked. They were horrified, and they didn't have any place to turn to. They couldn't turn to the police. They couldn't turn to the courts. The church wasn't supporting them. The media wasn't supporting them. So they felt so abandoned by all of the institutions that they'd grown up trusting all of their life, believing in all of their life. That's part of this story that I find quite interesting and disturbing and shocking, is that people who had lived a life, tried to be honest, worked hard, supported their neighbors, and took care of the land and the water, would be just totally abandoned in their struggle against shale oil. And this is also the strength of this story, is that in spite of all that, in spite of being beaten by the police, abandoned by the church, abandoned by the government, you know, one of the rather funny stories about this book is that the media would say, well, these people are IRA, you know, Irish Republican Army. And then they would say the IRA is in this community and they're up in the hills around the community and they're forcing people to do this. But IRA didn't have anything to do with it at all. You know, they were pretty busy up north in Belfast and other areas. But that was the kind of thing that people did, the kind of lies and misinformation that the media and the government spread about these resistors, the sheltered theo resistors.
You know, and anybody who has ever done any political work at all has experienced that similar thing, you know, whether you're trying to defend forests and the timber companies and the newspapers are just telling lie after lie. I mean, it doesn't matter what the issue is. This is all pretty standard operating procedure.
Absolutely. And, you know, people say, well, you're a radical. And I said, yes, I'm a radical. If wanting to save forests, animals, my own grandchildren, and my children, if I wanted to save them, and I'll do what I need to do, demonstrate or write or whatever it is, then I'm a radical. But I don't see anything radical about that. I think that's just being a human being. These people in Ireland were portrayed as radicals, but if you meet them and talk to them, and they're not radical in any way, shape or form, except that radical might mean saving your environment, protecting your children, protecting your animals, protecting your land, protecting your heritage. You know, that seems to be hardly radical. That just seems to be practical to me.
That's one of the things is people call me a radical environmentalist fairly often. And the truth is I'm actually pretty conservative. And what I mean by that is I just think it's a really stupid idea to wipe out salmon that you might want to eat tomorrow.
Absolutely.
And of course, the salmon have the right to exist for themselves. I'm not in any way going against that. But it's like, mm-hmm. This just seems really stupid. And it seems stupid. If you've been living here for, you know, however long they've been living in that part of Ireland and you've been fishing for five generations, it seems kind of a stupid idea to dump poison in the water. That's just.
Absolutely. But it shows the arrogance of these fossil fuel companies. You know, it shows what they feel they can do because they have the money and they have the power and they can corrupt governments and they can bribe people. And that's very frightening. But it also shows that they can't get away with everything everywhere. You know, they can't do it. And this is why I really believe if we continue, all of us on every level from every walk of life, to fight back, to try to save the planet. We might succeed. We might not, you know, because the forces of money and capitalism are so strong and so powerful. But you know, it's like during the Vietnam War when you tried to explain to people that the war was useless, worthless, and moreover, it was genocide. It took a long, long time for a lot of people to just get that through their head. You know, it was not World War II. It was not a noble cause. It was a genocidal cause. I don't know. I've been an educator all my life, but I have a lot of judgment on the educational system. I think we need to change it profoundly, close all the colleges and universities and start over again. Say, okay, what do we really need to do to preserve the planet, to save our children? What do we need to do? What do we need to be teaching? What do we need to be talking about? Because so much of what we're talking about is what I learned in school when I was going to school. And I went to school a long, long time ago.
You know, one thing that I'm really thinking about, I don't know why I'm so obsessed with the neighbors beating up neighbors, but mm-hmm. one of the things this makes me think of is, I don't know if you've ever had a friend or an acquaintance who is personally a sociopath. My experience when that happens is they can come into a community and they will set people at each other and everybody ends up getting in fights. Right. And it's, you know, it's not original for either you or me to say that corporations, if you look at how they work, I mean, they are sociopathic.
Oh, absolutely. And, yeah.
And so it's just really interesting to me that in addition to everything else that it does, that this force of evil that comes into town, it immediately pits family against family and pits neighbor against neighbor and creates perhaps unbridgeable conflict where it destroys community is what it does. As well as destroying the land, they destroy community.
They do, and they're very good at it. I mean, they've had a lot of experience. And the people in Ireland realized this. Once they began to see, they found out what Shell had done in Nigeria, for example. And once they began to unravel that and see what this company and other fossil fuel companies were about, how they did, then they began to understand what they were up against. And like you said, I believe that these companies are sociopathic, you know, psychopaths, whatever you want to call them. And how do you talk to a psychopath? How do you convince somebody that, you know, burning down a house just for fun is a good idea? I don't know. And I think what the people in Ireland found out, because they wrote letters and they attended conferences, they did everything within the system. And then they found that the system was not working for them and that this multinational corporation had no conscience. Their conscience was money. Their conscience was doing whatever they pleased, wherever they go. And people I talked to there, they said, well, you know, we're indigenous. We're like the indigenous people, and they do this to indigenous people all over the world. But they also were very angry and frustrated that Shell thought these people in Ireland, were stupid, that they didn't know how to read, that they didn't know how to react to something like this. They made the great presumptions, Shell did, about rural people who didn't have a lot of money, and some didn't have a lot of education, but they were very, very intelligent in the sense that they loved where they lived. They, you know, they loved the land and they did not want it destroyed, by anybody for any reason.
So we have about 3 or 4 minutes left, and can you, sort of sum up for us what are some of the lessons from that story that people in West Virginia or Alberta or the Philippines, anywhere listening to this, can take from this to help them resist?
Sure. Well, I think the first thing is it's kind of like military recruiters who come into high schools and promise the world to young men and women. And they lie. If you get to know these recruiters, they tell all kinds of lies. So the first thing is when these big companies come, wherever someone might be, don't believe them. Don't believe them at all. Don't believe one word they say when they could say, well, we're going to make you rich, or this is going to be a very prosperous area if you'll just allow us to do whatever we want. I would think people need to find out right away, do whatever they can, go to libraries, talk to people who know these companies, and begin a resistance very early on, because it's like the coal companies, in West Virginia. It's not going to benefit you. You might get some money sometime, and you need money to feed your family. But in the long run, I think that these corporations like Shell, these fossil fuel companies, their real goal, as strange as it sounds, is to just destroy everything for money, for the stockholders, for themselves. I find that hard to fathom, but I also believe that it's true. And I think people need to realize that, if they possibly can, that these corporations are not benign. They are psychopathic. They know how to manipulate everybody. They will buy the police. They will buy the local authorities. And you have to just, not say, what I do if I resist, I'm a radical. No, say if you resist, you're just trying to save your own children, your friends, your neighbors, your land, your country. What belongs to you? Because it doesn't, this world, it makes me very upset. It doesn't belong to Shell. It doesn't belong to these multinational corporations. It belongs to them only because they have the money. And they'll use the force, and they'll use bribes, and they'll use violence in order to perpetuate whatever it is that they want to do, whether it's building a pipeline, whether it's building a refinery, whatever it's fracking, or whatever it is they want to do. So I just encourage people immediately, when these companies come to your region, and they are, of course, coming all over the world, all over the country, to get together, talk, read, study, and see what these corporations have done in other parts of the world, because people will say, well, you're exaggerating, Wilcox, or you're exaggerating, you're making this up. And when you read about it, when you find, because there are plenty of books, there's lots of information about it, then you'll see, no, people who want to resist these corporations are not exaggerating. There really isn't any way to exaggerate the terrible things that these fossil fuel companies have done and are continuing to do to our world, to Mother Earth. There's no way to exaggerate. And also, to me, really fighting back against them, that's patriotism. People say, oh, you're a communist, you're a socialist, you're a radical, you're this. No, I say that's patriotic. My desire to protect this country against the fossil fuel companies, I think, is the height of patriotic behavior. It's not violating that at all. Resistance is again, going back to Vietnam, I thought what we were doing was quite noble. We were trying to save our own soldiers. We were trying to save the Vietnamese. We were trying to save the environment in Vietnam. And people who called us all the things they called us and beat us up, didn't understand what we were doing. It's happening now. Of course, as there are lots of names that you can be called for trying to do, save the salmon, save the river, save the trees, save the animals. People will call you names and insult you and humiliate you and maybe even threaten you. But all that, to me, really doesn't matter. You have to do what you do in order to protect what belongs to us, belongs to all of us as Americans, as citizens of the world, as human beings. All the water and the animals and the food, and it belongs to us. It doesn't belong to these corporations.
Well, thank you so much for this conversation, and thank you for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Fred Wilcox. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.